This is an ad by Regain Couples Therapy.
Let's be honest. Loving your partner doesn't mean you always like them, and guess what? That's normal.
Regain, powered by BetterHelp, offers couples therapy that's flexible, affordable, and 100% online.
Whether you're reconnecting or working through conflict, Regain is here to support you both.
See why people wish they'd tried couples therapy sooner. Visit regain.com/couplespod to get 10% off your first month. That's regain.com/couplespod.
Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again. Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
Lowe's knows how to set off your July 4th with savings. Right now, buy one, get one free on select one coat coverage interior paint via Visa gift card rebate. Plus, get two select 2 or 2.5 quart red, white, and blue annuals for just $10. Hurry, these July 4th deals won't last long. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 7/9. Selection varies by location. While supplies last, excludes Alaska and Hawaii. More terms and restrictions apply. See Lowe's.com/rebates for more details.
If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.
Story one, I didn't recognize the smell at first. It wasn't the sharp sterility of a hospital or the sour notes of bleach left behind by the janitors. No, it was something earthy, almost metallic, that had seeped into my uniform. Even now, it makes my stomach churn when I remember that night. My name is Amaka. I'm from Enugu, Nigeria, but I had been working at a mental health facility in the outskirts of the city for 3 years. Most days were routine, and some patients even became like family. But there was one patient, her name was Grace, and she redefined my understanding of fear. Grace had been admitted about 2 months before the incident. Her file was incomplete, but the scant notes we had described her as volatile and nonverbal. She was small, frail looking even, but don't let appearances fool you. Beneath that thin frame was a strength none of us could explain. It was around 10:30 p.m., the tail end of my night shift. I had just finished checking on the patients when I heard muffled noises coming from Grace's room. It wasn't uncommon for her to make sounds during the night, grunts, whispers, sometimes low, guttural hums. But this was different. It was loud, rhythmic, almost like chanting. I paused outside her door, debating whether to enter or call for backup. My colleague, Kioma, had warned me about Grace's unpredictability. "Always go with someone," she'd said. But that night I was alone, and for reasons I still can't explain, I opened the door anyway. What I saw, I'll never forget. Grace was sitting cross-legged on the floor, her hospital gown soaked in blood. At first I thought she'd hurt herself, but her arms and legs were untouched. The blood, as far as I could tell, wasn't hers. It pooled around her, dark and sticky, like ink. Her lips moved rapidly, but no sound came out. That rhythmic noise, the chanting, I realized then, wasn't coming from her mouth. It was coming from the walls. I froze. My instincts told me to run, but my legs felt like they'd been bolted to the floor. Grace looked up at me. Her eyes, usually vacant and distant, were now sharp and focused. And then she smiled. "Amaka," she whispered. My name. I hadn't told her my name. I hadn't spoken to her directly since she arrived. But she knew. Before I could react, she raised her hands, and that's when I saw it. The thing she was holding. It wasn't human. It wasn't animal. It was a mangled, fleshy mass that seemed to pulse in her grip, like it was alive. She tilted her head, studying me, as if daring me to take a step closer. "Where did you get that?" I asked, my voice trembling. She didn't answer. Instead, she began humming, a tune so hauntingly familiar that chills ran down my spine. It was a lullaby my grandmother used to sing to me when I was a child. There was no way Grace could know that. The room seemed to shrink as the walls closed in, the chanting growing louder. I looked behind me, hoping someone, anyone, had heard the commotion. But the hallway was empty. When I turned back to Grace, she was on her feet. The mangled mass in her hands began to stretch, its veins throbbing, its shape twisting into something unrecognizable. "Stay back!" I shouted, my voice cracking. But Grace didn't move. Her smile widened, and I swear her eyes turned black, deep, void-like, as though she had no soul left. And then she said it, the words that haunt me to this day. "It's yours now." Before I could even process what she meant, the thing in her hands flung itself at me. I felt it hit my chest, cold and slimy, before it disappeared. Yes, disappeared. It didn't fall to the floor or leave a trace. It was just gone. But the weight of it, the sensation of it burrowing into my skin, stayed with me. I stumbled back, my breathing erratic. Grace didn't chase me or make a move to stop me. She just stood there, humming that lullaby, blood dripping from her gown. I ran out of the room, out of the hospital, and I didn't stop until I reached home. I never went back to work. I couldn't. Story 2. I didn't know what fear really felt like until I met him. My name's Tunde, and I work at a pediatric mental health facility in Lagos, Nigeria. I've seen my fair share of troubled kids, ones who lash out, ones who withdraw completely. But this boy, let's call him Daniel, was different. He wasn't loud or aggressive. He was quiet, calculating, and that made him all the more terrifying. Daniel was 10 years old when he was admitted. His parents brought him in after an incident they couldn't ignore. Before that, they'd brushed off his behavior as just a phase. The dead animals in the neighborhood. "Boys will be boys," the shattered glass mixed into dog food at the park. "He's just curious." But the night he woke them up with a meat cleaver in his hands, they finally realized something was seriously wrong. I wasn't there for the cleaver incident, but I heard about it from his parents during intake. They were pale, shaking, and clearly terrified of their own child. "He said he wanted to see if our insides were like the cat's," his mother whispered, her voice barely audible. The cat she was referring to was their neighbor's. A poor creature Daniel had impaled on a spiked fence post just weeks before. When I first met Daniel, he didn't seem like the monster his parents described. He was small for his age, with big, innocent-looking eyes and a mop of curly hair. He sat quietly in the corner of the room, his hands folded neatly in his lap. But there was something about the way he looked at me, like he was studying me, dissecting me with his gaze, that sent chills down my spine. The incident happened about a week after he was admitted. It was late, around 2 a.m., and I was doing my rounds. Most of the kids were asleep, their rooms dark and silent. But when I reached Daniel's room, I noticed his door was slightly ajar. I pushed it open, expecting to find him awake, maybe reading or playing with one of the toys we'd given him. Instead, I found him standing in the middle of the room, holding something in his hands. At first, I couldn't tell what it was. It looked like a bundle of cloth, dark and wet. But as I stepped closer, the smell hit me. Metallic, pungent, unmistakably blood. My heart started racing as I realized what he was holding. It was a bird, its feathers matted and soaked in red, its neck twisted at an unnatural angle. "Daniel," I said, my voice shaking, "what are you doing?" He looked up at me, his expression calm, almost serene. "It's not the same," he said softly. "What's not the same?" I asked, trying to keep my voice steady. "The insides," he replied, tilting his head as he examined the bird. "They're not like the cat's." I felt my stomach turn. "Where did you get that?" I demanded, my voice rising despite my efforts to stay calm. He didn't answer. Instead, he took a step toward me, holding the bird out like an offering. "Do you want to see?" he asked, his tone eerily polite. I backed away, my mind racing. How had he gotten the bird? The windows in his room were locked, and there was no way he could have snuck out without someone noticing. But there it was, undeniable proof that he'd somehow managed to catch and kill it. "I need you to put that down, Daniel," I said, trying to sound authoritative. "Right now." He didn't move. His eyes locked onto mine, and for a moment I felt like he could see right through me. Then, without warning, he dropped the bird onto the floor. The sound it made, a wet, sickening thud, echoed in the room. "I don't think you understand," he said, his voice barely above a whisper. "It's not about the insides. It's about what's inside." I didn't know what he meant, and honestly, I didn't want to know. I called for backup, my hands shaking as I pressed the button on my radio. When the other staff arrived, Daniel didn't resist. He let them take him away, his expression calm and unbothered, as if nothing had happened. I never saw him again after that night. He was transferred to a higher security facility, and I heard rumors that his behavior only escalated. Story 3. I'll never forget that night, no matter how hard I try. My name is Chris, and I've been working as an intake coordinator at a psychiatric hospital in Phoenix, Arizona, for 6 years. I've dealt with all kinds of people. People having breakdowns, people hallucinating, people so desperate for help it breaks your heart. But this was different. This wasn't a person who needed help. This was something else entirely. It started with the sound of boots stomping across the tile floor. I looked up from my desk and saw two police officers coming through the main doors. Between them was a man, tall, broad-shouldered, head hung low. His clothes were filthy, ripped in places, and there was dried blood smeared across the front of his shirt. He wasn't resisting, wasn't saying a word, just letting the cops guide him forward. "This is Musa," one of the officers said. "Picked him up downtown. Found him wandering around an alley, acting weird. Said he didn't know where he was, but..." He paused and glanced at his partner. "There's something off about this guy. Thought you might want to take a look." I nodded and led them toward one of our secure observation rooms. It was routine. Get the patient in, lock the door, start the assessment. Nothing unusual. The first cop stayed in the room with Musa, while the second one followed me back to the intake desk to pull.
This is an ad by Regain Couples Therapy. Let's be honest. Loving your partner doesn't mean you always like them, and guess what? That's normal. Regain, powered by BetterHelp, offers couples therapy that's flexible, affordable, and 100% online. Whether you're reconnecting or working through conflict, Regain is here to support you both. See why people wish they'd tried couples therapy sooner. Visit regain.com/couplespod to get 10% off your first month. That's regain.com/couplespod.
Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again. Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
Lowe's knows that no matter your paint project, saving is at the top of your list. That's why when you shop today, you can buy one, get one free select Valspar and HGTV Home by Sherwin-Williams one-coat coverage interior paints via rebate. Shop these deals in-store or online today at Lowe's. We help, you save. Rebate in form of Visa gift card equal to 100% off the second eligible item purchased before or after applicable discounts, if any. See details. Offer ends 7/9.
pull up his records. I figured we'd find a history of drug abuse or prior psychiatric holds. That's usually how cases like this go. But before I could even start searching, my partner Rachel, who was watching the observation room monitors, suddenly jumped up from her chair. "Chris," she shouted, "something's wrong." I turned to her, confused. "What do you mean?" She didn't answer. She just bolted down the hallway toward the observation rooms. I hesitated for a split second before running after her, the second officer close behind. My heart was pounding, a sick sense of dread settling in my gut. When we got to the observation room, the door was open. Rachel ran inside, and I followed, skidding to a stop when I saw what was happening. Musa was on top of the first officer, beating him with his handcuffs like a weapon. The cop was trying to shield himself, blood pouring from a gash on his forehead. Musa's movements were wild, almost animalistic, but there was something calculated about the way he swung those cuffs, like he knew exactly where to hit to cause the most damage. "Get off him!" Rachel screamed, rushing forward to grab Musa. The second cop pushed past me and tackled him to the ground, wrestling the cuffs out of his hand. It took all three of us to hold him down until security arrived with a sedative. Even then, Musa fought like a man possessed, thrashing and snarling as if he had superhuman strength. When it was finally over, I stood in the doorway, catching my breath and trying to process what had just happened. The first officer was sitting against the wall, his face pale, blood dripping from his wounds. Rachel was shaking, her hands covered in red. And Musa? Musa was unconscious on the floor, his chest rising and falling like nothing had happened. That's when I noticed his hands. I don't know why I looked. Maybe it was the way they were splayed out in front of him, fingers stretched like claws. Or maybe it was the blood, so much blood, covering his skin. But something drew my attention, and I crouched down for a closer look. At first, I couldn't quite put my finger on it. His hands seemed wrong somehow, misshapen. And then it hit me. "Musa doesn't have thumbs," I muttered, my voice barely audible. Rachel looked at me, her brow furrowed. "What?" "His thumbs," I said louder this time, pointing at his hands. "He doesn't have them. They're gone." She stared at me like I'd lost my mind, but then she crouched down too, her eyes widening as she realized I was right. Both of Musa's thumbs were missing. Not just the thumbs themselves, but the ball sockets, the entire joint. It was like they'd been surgically removed, the skin healed over in smooth pink scars. "How the hell did he get those cuffs off?" Rachel whispered, her voice trembling. "Without thumbs." I shook my head, my mind racing. The police hadn't noticed when they cuffed him. They were probably too focused on getting him restrained, on keeping themselves safe. But now it was obvious. Without thumbs, the cuffs would have just slid off his hands like bracelets. The second officer, who had been tending to his partner, stepped closer, his face pale. "Who the hell is this guy?" he muttered. "What kind of person doesn't have thumbs?" The question hung in the air, unanswered. What kind of person, indeed? And why? What kind of life had Musa lived to end up like this? What kind of world did he come from where things like this were normal? We never got the answers. Musa never spoke, not a single word. He was transferred to a high-security facility the next day, and I didn't see him again. What kind of person doesn't have thumbs? What kind of world do they belong to? Story 4. I've worked night shifts at Springview Psychiatric Center in Tacoma for 7 years. Night shifts are different, quieter, but always unpredictable. Most people don't understand what that means until they've walked these linoleum hallways at 3 a.m. Marcus Rodriguez wasn't like other patients. From the moment they transferred him from the state prison psych unit, something felt off. His file was thick. Pages of violent incidents, psychological evaluations that read like horror novels. But nothing prepared me for that night. I was doing my standard rounds, clipboard in hand, when I first noticed him. He was sitting perfectly still in the common area, staring directly at the blank white wall. No movement, no blinking, just staring. "Everything okay, Marcus?" I asked, maintaining a professional distance. He didn't respond, didn't even acknowledge my presence. The other night staff knew to keep their distance. Marcus had a reputation. Two orderlies had already been hospitalized after incidents with him, one with a broken nose, another with a fractured wrist. Around 2:17 a.m., everything changed. Marcus slowly turned his head. His eyes weren't human. They were cold, calculating, like someone studying an insect before crushing it. No emotion, pure calculation. "You hear them?" he whispered. I pretended not to understand. "Hear what?" His laugh wasn't human. It was a broken mechanical sound that seemed to come from somewhere deep inside his chest. "The signals. They're talking, always talking." I radioed the charge nurse. Protocol demanded cautious observation. Marcus stood, 6'4" of pure muscle and unpredictability. His hospital gown seemed too small, stretched tight across his shoulders. "They want me to do something," he said, each word precise and measured. I took a step back. My hand was already near the emergency call button. He moved faster than someone his size should be able to move. One moment he was across the room, the next he was inches from my face. I could smell institutional soap and something else, something metallic. "The signals," he repeated, "they're getting louder." Then he did something I'll never forget. He pressed his index finger against his temple and made a sharp, precise tapping motion. Tap, tap, tap. The alarms in my head were screaming louder than any actual alarm could. "Marcus, step back," I said, trying to keep my voice steady. He didn't. Instead, he leaned closer. "Do you know what happens when the signals get too loud?" I didn't want to know, but some part of me, the part that had seen too many long nights in this place, knew I was going to hear it anyway. "They make me do things," he whispered. That's when I saw it, a slight tremor in his right hand, a micro movement that suggested something was about to happen. I hit the emergency button. What followed was chaos, but not the chaos you'd expect. Marcus didn't attack. He didn't scream. He just stood there, tapping his temple. Tap, tap, tap. When the backup staff arrived, he was already sitting down, calm as could be, like nothing had happened. Story 5. I never thought I'd find myself working in a place like St. Margaret's Forensic Psychiatric Hospital. It was tucked away on the edge of the countryside near Freiburg, Germany, surrounded by dense forests that seemed like they could swallow you whole. My name's Johannes, and at the time, I was 23. And completing a mandatory 2-month internship before starting my medical studies. I figured it would be an opportunity to learn, but by the end, I knew I'd never set foot in a place like that again. St. Margaret's had two wings. One housed the acute psychotic patients, the ones who screamed at walls, clutched invisible enemies, or just stared blankly into the abyss. The second wing was reserved for long-term cases, patients who had been there for years, sometimes decades. They were quieter, heavily medicated, and seemingly adjusted. That's where I was stationed. It seemed safer, less chaotic. I was wrong. One patient in particular stood out. His name was Marcus. He was a former accountant, 35 years old, but looked younger. He was tall, well-spoken, with sharp, angular features that gave him an air of sophistication. He wasn't like the other patients. Marcus had a presence that unnerved me, yet fascinated others. The nurses joked about his charm, how he could talk anyone into anything. But I felt it, something rotten beneath the surface. They said Marcus was there because of a workplace rivalry gone horribly wrong. 10 years ago, he'd killed his colleague, dismembered the body, and staged it in their shared office as a grotesque warning to others. But that wasn't the end of his violence. After his admission to St. Margaret's, he tortured his roommate to death over an argument about a chair. And yet, there he was, calm, poised, utterly terrifying in his stillness. The worst part? Marcus always seemed to know things, things he shouldn't. He'd say something casually like, "You didn't sleep well last night, did you?" Or, "Your girlfriend doesn't like the hospital much, does she?" I never told him anything about my personal life. I never even mentioned I had a girlfriend. But he'd smile, a slow, knowing smile, and that was enough to send shivers down my spine. One night, I was working the late shift alone in the office. My colleagues were out doing rounds checking on the patients. I had the monitors to keep me company, the black and white surveillance feeds from every corner of the ward. It was quiet, too quiet. I remember staring at the screens, scanning the empty hallways. Marcus's room was on camera 3. He was sitting on his bed, staring at the wall, motionless. It was almost soothing to see him like that, contained. And then the feed cut out. I frowned, tapping the monitor. The screen flickered back on, but Marcus wasn't in his room anymore. The bed was empty. My pulse quickened. I switched to the hallway camera outside his door. Nothing. Just an empty corridor stretching into darkness. "He's probably in the bathroom," I muttered to myself, trying to keep calm. But the unease settled in my chest like a heavy weight. Then I heard it, a faint knock. I turned toward the office door, but it was locked, as always. I felt the hair on my arm stand on end. "Johannes," a voice called softly from the other side. It was Marcus. My heart pounded in my chest. "Marcus," I said, my voice trembling. "You're supposed to be in your room." Silence. I stared at the door, my hand hovering over the alarm button on my desk. I knew the security protocols. Patients couldn't leave their rooms without staff authorization. The locks were automatic. It was impossible for him to be out. And yet, the knock came again, louder this time. "Johannes," Marcus said, his voice dripping with something I couldn't place. "Malice, maybe, or worse. I know what you did." "What are you talking about?" I demanded, my voice cracking. I pressed the alarm button, but the siren didn't activate. Nothing happened. My pager was dead too. I felt trapped, like a rat in a cage. Suddenly the doorknob twisted. My breath caught in my throat. The locks were supposed to be unbreakable, but the door creaked open, inch by inch, until Marcus stepped inside. He wasn't supposed to be there. He couldn't be there. But there he was, smiling that same slow, knowing smile. How did you get out?" I stammered, backing away until I hit the wall. Marcus didn't answer. He just stood there watching me with those cold, calculating eyes. "You don't belong here," he said finally, and it felt like a verdict. I don't remember much after that. Maybe I blacked out from fear, or maybe my mind couldn't process what was happening. When I came to, my colleagues were shaking me awake. The door was locked again, and Marcus was back in his room, staring at the wall like he'd never left. But the cameras showed nothing. No door opening, no Marcus in the hallway. Just static. I quit the internship the next day. I told them it was stress, in that the late shifts were too much for me. But the truth was, I couldn't stay there. I couldn't stay anywhere near him. Story 6, I wasn't new to working night shifts at hospitals, but my experience in a small psychiatric facility in the outskirts of Heidelberg was something else entirely. My name's Klaus, and back in the early 2000s and 10s, I worked as a nursing assistant while trying to save for my nursing degree. The job itself was manageable: routine check-ins, monitoring patients, administering medications. Nothing I couldn't handle. That is, until I met Frau Ritter. Frau Ritter was in her late 60s, an older lady with an unassuming demeanor. She had been admitted after a breakdown triggered by her husband's death. On the surface, she seemed fine, mild anxiety, occasional outbursts of emotion, but nothing out of the ordinary. When I joined the team, she had already been there for about 2 weeks and was scheduled for discharge within days. Everyone said she was ready to go. That Wednesday started like any other. I was on the evening shift, and Frau Ritter was scheduled for her daily meeting with me. I knocked lightly on her door and stepped inside. "Guten Abend, Frau Ritter," I said with a smile. She was sitting by the window, knitting something. A scarf, perhaps. She looked up and gave me a warm, almost maternal smile. "Good evening, Klaus," she replied softly. Her voice was steady and her demeanor calm. We chatted for a while about her plans after discharge. She was excited to reunite with her daughter and return to her quaint house in the countryside. Everything seemed perfectly normal. But something changed that night. Around 8 p.m., her daughter arrived for an unscheduled visit. I was in the break room when I heard their voices through the thin walls, heated, hushed but sharp. It wasn't my place to intervene, so I stayed put. After about 20 minutes, the daughter stormed out, her heels clicking furiously down the hallway. Frau Ritter didn't come out of her room for the rest of the evening. The following morning, I found her sitting on her bed. Her usually neat gray hair was in disarray, and strands of it littered her lap and the floor around her. She had been pulling it out in clumps. Her eyes, once warm and kind, were wide and unfocused, staring at the wall with a vacant intensity. She looked possessed. "Frau Ritter?" I said cautiously, stepping closer. She didn't respond. Her hands were clenched tightly in her lap, her knuckles white. "Are you okay? What happened?" She turned her head slowly to face me, and I felt a chill run down my spine. Her lips parted, and in a flat, almost mechanical voice, she asked, "Did I hurt you?" The question caught me off guard. "Hurt me?" I repeated. "No, you haven't hurt me, Frau Ritter. But you seem upset. Do you want to talk about it?" She didn't answer. She just kept repeating the same question, over and over. "Did I hurt you? Did I hurt you? Did I hurt you?" Her voice grew louder, more insistent, until she was nearly shouting. I called for another nurse to assist me, but by the time they arrived, Frau Ritter had soiled herself. The stench filled the room, but she didn't seem to notice. She sat there, stiff and unblinking, whispering that same question under her breath. We decided to move her to a different room for observation, but when we tried to help her up, she resisted with surprising strength for someone her age. Her nails dug into my arm as she hissed, "I didn't mean to. I didn't mean to hurt them." "Hurt who, Frau Ritter?" I asked, trying to keep my voice steady. She didn't answer. Instead, she began to weep, silent, racking sobs that seemed to come from somewhere deep within her. We eventually managed to transfer her to the observation room, but she remained in that strange, semi-catatonic state, muttering to herself and occasionally screaming out of nowhere. The transformation was startling. Less than 24 hours ago, she had been a completely different person. By the end of my shift, the decision had been made to transfer her to a higher security facility, better equipped to handle her condition. As the paramedics wheeled her out, she suddenly sat up on the stretcher, her eyes locking onto mine. "It wasn't me," she said, her voice clear and steady for the first time since the incident. "It wasn't me, Klaus. It was her." Before I could ask what she meant, she slumped back onto the stretcher, her body going limp. The paramedics hurried her out, leaving me standing there, shaken to my core. To this day, I don't know what triggered that sudden change in her. Was it something her daughter said during their argument, or was it something else? Story 7. I didn't start out afraid of him. That's important to remember, because the fear didn't come from anything obvious. Nothing you'd point to and say, "That's it. That's the reason." No, it was deeper than that. Like something primal in my gut, warning me I was in the presence of something unnatural. At the time, I was working in a mental health agency in Chicago. I handled intakes for homeless clients, most of whom had histories of drug abuse, violence, and untreated mental illnesses. It wasn't glamorous, but I liked to think I was making a difference. The man showed up one rainy afternoon. I just sat down at my desk with a lukewarm coffee when I heard the receptionist buzz me. "Kurt, got a new intake here for you." I grabbed my clipboard and headed to the waiting room. He was sitting by the window, staring out at the rain streaking the glass. I remember he wore an old army surplus jacket and faded jeans, but his boots were polished. That stuck with me, how the rest of him was so unkempt. Yet his boots gleamed like he'd spent hours on them. "Hi there," I said, trying to sound welcoming. "I'm Kurt. Let's head back to my office and we'll get started." He didn't say much, just nodded and followed me down the hall. His name was Anthony, early 60s, diagnosed with schizophrenia, currently living on the streets. None of that was unusual. Most of our clients fit the same profile. He spoke calmly about his drug use, his paranoia, and his violent outbursts. "Sometimes I get mad," he admitted, his voice steady. "I think people are plotting against me, so I take care of them." I'd heard similar things before. Drug-fueled paranoia was nothing new. "What do you mean by take care of them?" I asked, jotting notes on my clipboard. "I cut them up," he said matter-of-factly. And for the first time, he looked at me directly. His eyes were dark, flat, like two holes in his face. "You know, so they stop bothering me." I froze, my pen hovering above the paper. "Cut them up?" He nodded. "With a knife. You learn on the streets. It's the only way to survive sometimes." There was no remorse in his voice, just a simple acceptance. He talked about violence the way most people talk about the weather, casual, detached. but it wasn't until he mentioned his wife that I felt the first stirrings of fear. "I used to be married," he said suddenly, changing the subject. "A long time ago. She was beautiful. I loved her more than anything." "That's nice," I said cautiously, unsure where this was going. "She died," he continued, smiling faintly. "I killed her." I stopped writing and looked up at him. "You killed her?" "She was unhappy, depressed. The voices told me it was the right thing to do. So I got my shotgun and..." He mimed firing, his hands gripping an imaginary weapon. Bang, just like that. The room felt colder somehow, like the temperature had dropped while we were talking. My throat was dry and I swallowed hard. "What happened after that?" "I felt better," he said, still smiling, "like a heavy cloud lifted from my head. I was finally free. It wasn't the murder that scared me. I'd worked with people who'd committed terrible crimes before. What scared me was the way he talked about it. Like it was a relief, like killing his wife was just another chore he'd checked off his to-do list. There was a blissful serenity in his expression that made my skin crawl. After the intake, I passed his file to my supervisor, hoping he'd be assigned to someone else. I didn't want to work with him, but fate had other plans. Anthony was assigned to my caseload, though I didn't see him again after that first meeting. He kept missing appointments, and eventually I heard he'd left town to return to his hometown. I should have felt relieved, but I didn't. In the weeks that followed, I kept seeing him, or thought I did. Sometimes it was just a fleeting glimpse, a man in a crowd wearing an army surplus jacket, or someone with polished boots walking down the street. Once, I swore I saw him watching me from across the subway platform, but when I looked again, he was gone. I told myself it was just my mind playing tricks. Anthony was hundreds of miles away, living his life, wherever that might be. Story 8. It wasn't the kind of job you bragged about. Working the overnight shift at a mental health facility hidden deep in the woods didn't exactly scream dream career, but it paid the bills, and honestly, the isolation was comforting. The building itself used to be an old ski resort, creaky floors, drafty hallways, and way too many stories about strange things that had supposedly happened there. The staff called it character. I called it unnerving. Most nights were quiet. By 11 p.m., most of the patients were in bed. Occasionally, there'd be someone who couldn't sleep, and they'd wander into the lounge to chat. Nothing too wild. But then there was Mike. Mike had come to us a couple of weeks earlier. He was struggling, severely detached from reality, constantly questioning what was real and what wasn't. You'd think he'd be loud or volatile, but no, he was quiet. That was the unnerving part. He'd just sit there, mumbling to himself or staring at the walls like he was waiting for something to happen. That night, it was just me and another counselor in the office. We were going over paperwork, enjoying the rare silence, when Mike shuffled in. He wasn't supposed to be wandering the halls that late, but we didn't get on him too hard about it. He looked pale more than usual, and his eyes were wide like he'd just seen something he couldn't unsee. "What's going on, Mike?" I asked, setting my pen down. He didn't answer at first. He just stood there, scratching at his arm and glancing over his shoulder. Finally, he said, "There's something in the hallway." I shot a look at the other counselor. "Something?" I asked. "Like what?" "I don't know," Mike said, his voice barely a whisper. "It's just there. It's watching." Now, I wasn't new to patients seeing or hearing things that weren't there. It came with the territory, but the way Mike said it sent a small chill crawling up my neck. Still, I kept my voice calm. "All right, let's check it out. Come with us." The three of us stepped into the hallway. The lights buzzed faintly overhead, casting long, flickering shadows across the floor. Everything was still, too still. I glanced around, seeing nothing but empty corridors and closed doors. "See," I said, keeping my tone light, "nothing here. It's all in your..." Before I could finish, something moved. It was fast, too fast to register fully. A mass of hair, black and tangled, floated out of one of the rooms, like it had been carried on an invisible breeze. It didn't touch the ground, didn't make a sound. It just hung there in the air for a couple of seconds, twisting and shifting unnaturally, before darting back into the room it came from. All three of us froze. "What the hell was that?" The other counselor whispered, his voice shaking. Mike didn't say anything. His eyes were locked on the door the thing had disappeared into. I felt my heart pounding in my chest, every instinct in me screaming to run back to the office and lock the door. But instead, I stepped forward. "I'm checking it out," I muttered, more to myself than anyone else. "Are you insane?" the other counselor hissed. "We should call someone." "Call who? Ghostbusters?" I shot back, trying to keep my voice steady. "Just stay here with Mike." I reached the door, my hand hovering over the knob. My throat felt dry, and I had to force myself to breathe. Slowly, I turned the knob and pushed the door open. The room was empty. No patients, no massive hair. Just a neatly made bed, a dresser, and a chair by the window. Nothing out of the ordinary. But the air felt different, heavy, charged, like the room itself was holding its breath. "Hello," I called out, my voice barely above a whisper. No response. I stepped further inside, scanning every corner, every shadow. There was nothing, but the feeling didn't leave. If anything, it got worse, pressing against my chest like an invisible weight. It was hard to breathe, hard to think. That's when I heard it, a faint sound, almost like a whisper coming from the corner of the room. It wasn't words, just a low, guttural noise that sent ice shooting through my veins. I turned toward the corner, my hands trembling. Nothing, just shadows. I backed out of the room, my heart hammering in my chest. I slammed the door shut and bolted back down the hallway to the office, where Mike and the other counselor were waiting. "Well?" the counselor asked, his face pale. "There's nothing in there," I said, trying to sound more confident than I felt. "It's empty." Mike shook his head slowly. "It's never empty," he murmured. We didn't talk about it after that. The rest of the shift passed in tense silence, every creak and groan of the old building putting us all on edge. When the sun finally rose, I clocked out and drove home. But I couldn't shake the feeling that something had followed me. Whatever that thing was, it wasn't just in Mike's head. I don't know what I saw that night, but I know one thing for sure. I never worked another overnight shift at that place again. Story 9. I'll never forget that night. It was my first time working the schizophrenia unit during a night shift, and I was already on edge. The hospital I worked at in Baltimore wasn't exactly known for being calm, but this unit had a reputation. The staff warned me about a particular patient. Let's call him James. They said he didn't sleep at night and had a history of attacking male staff. I'm not exactly intimidating at 5'6" and 140 pounds, so you can imagine how thrilled I was to meet him. It was around 2 a.m. when I first saw him. I was doing my observation rounds, clipboard in hand, trying to stay awake. The hallway was dimly lit, the kind of lighting that makes shadows seem alive. James stepped out of his room without a sound. He was stocky, maybe 5'8" and 160 pounds, but he carried himself like he was bigger. His eyes locked onto mine, and I felt a chill run down my spine. "Hey," I said, trying to sound casual. "I'm David, just doing my rounds." He didn't respond. Instead, he tilted his head slightly, like he was studying me. Then he whispered something I couldn't make out and gestured for me to come closer. I hesitated. The staff had warned me about him, and every instinct in my body was screaming at me to stay put. But I didn't want to escalate the situation, so I took a cautious step forward. "What's up?" I asked, keeping my voice steady. He whispered again, his voice so low I couldn't understand him. "Sorry, can you repeat that?" I said, leaning in slightly. His expression darkened, and I could see the frustration building in his eyes. He whispered again, louder this time, but still unintelligible. "I'm sorry, I can't hear you," I said, taking a small step back. That's when he spoke clearly for the first time. "Come on, man," he said, his voice calm but firm. "I ain't gonna hit you." My heart skipped a beat. The way he said it, so matter-of-fact, like he'd read my mind, made my stomach twist. Against my better judgment, I followed him to his room. He stepped inside and gestured for me to follow. I hesitated at the doorway, my hand hovering near the panic button on my pager. "Come in," he said, his tone almost impatient. "I just want to show you something." I took a deep breath and stepped inside, keeping my back to the wall. James walked over to the door and started to close it. My heart was pounding so hard I could hear it in my ears. "What are you doing?" I asked, trying to keep my voice steady. "Relax," he said, flashing me a grin that didn't reach his eyes. "It's just a picture." I was about 2 seconds away from bolting when he pointed to the back of the door. There, taped to the wood, was a picture of a baby dressed in a flower costume. It was one of those cutesy stock photos you'd see on a greeting card. James stared at it for a moment, then turned to me with a wide smile. "Isn't it funny?" he asked, his voice filled with genuine amusement. I didn't know what to say. My brain was still in fight-or-flight mode, and here he was, laughing at a picture of a baby in a flower costume. "Yeah," I said finally, forcing a chuckle. "It's cute." James nodded, satisfied, and sat down on his bed. "You can go now," he said, waving me off like I was dismissed. I didn't need to be told twice. I left his room and practically sprinted back to the nurse's station. My hands were shaking as I wrote down my notes. The rest of the night passed without incident, but I couldn't shake the feeling that I'd narrowly avoided something terrible. To this day, I don't know what James's intentions were. Maybe he really just wanted to share a laugh over that picture. Or maybe he was testing me, seeing how far he could push before I broke. Either way, it was a night I'll never forget. Story 10. I wasn't new to the job. By the time I worked at the state-run children's facility outside of Little Rock, Arkansas, I'd been dealing with difficult kids for a few years. Most of them were angry, broken, and deep down, just hurt children lashing out at a world that had been cruel to them. I tried to remind myself of that every day. But then there was Ethan. Ethan was only 8 years old when he was brought to us. He came in looking like any other scared kid, small for his age, pale, and clutching a stuffed rabbit that looked like it had been through hell. But Ethan wasn't like the other kids. The day he arrived, we were briefed on his case. He had shot and killed his younger sister. An accident, he claimed. He said he just wanted to see what would happen. The thing about Ethan was that he wasn't like the rest of the kids in the facility. He didn't throw tantrums, didn't fight, didn't push back against authority. He followed the rules, smiled at staff, and even thanked us for meals. On paper, he was the model resident, but there was something about him that never sat right with me. Maybe it was how he never showed any remorse for what he did, not once. In therapy sessions, he'd shrug and say, "I didn't mean to hurt her," and that was it. No tears, no guilt, just nothing. He stayed with us for over a year. During that time, I kept my distance. I couldn't explain why, but being around Ethan made my skin crawl. Maybe it was the way his eyes would linger on you just a little too long, like he was studying you, or the way he'd smile at you, sweet, innocent, and utterly hollow. Eventually, the state decided they wouldn't pay for him to stay in such a secure facility anymore. He was deemed stabilized and transferred to a treatment home. One of our nurses, Greg, volunteered to take him in. Greg had a big heart and a bigger house, with a couple of other foster kids living there already. "He's just a kid," Greg told me. "He deserves a chance." At first, everything seemed fine. Greg would bring Ethan to visit us every now and then, and he'd always have glowing reports. "He's a great kid," Greg would say, grinning. "Helps out around the house, gets along with the other boys. No trouble at all." But then a few weeks later, Greg called me. He sounded shaken. "You ever hear anything weird about Ethan?" he asked. "Weird how?" I replied. "One of my other kids, Jesse, keeps saying Ethan sneaks into his room at night with a knife. Says Ethan stands there, just watching him." I felt a cold knot form in my stomach. "Does he have a knife?" I asked. Greg sighed. "Not that I've seen. Jesse lies a lot, you know that. But I don't know, something feels off." I told him to trust his gut. "If you think something's wrong, you need to check." A week later, Greg called again. This time, he wasn't calm. "I caught him," he said, his voice shaking. "I caught Ethan going into Jesse's room last night. I installed a camera and I saw it." "What was he doing?" I asked, dread creeping into my voice. "He had a knife," Greg said. "He stole it from another kid at school. He was just standing there by Jesse's bed holding it." I didn't know what to say. I pictured Ethan in my mind, his small frame, his innocent smile. And then I imagined him standing over someone in the dark, a knife in his hand. "What did you do?" I asked finally. "I called the caseworker," Greg said. "They're sending him back to a lockdown facility." That was the last I ever heard about Ethan. He was transferred to another facility, far away from ours.
Thanks for watching. Don't leave before leaving a like to this video. Also, hit the subscribe button to support my work. And as always, have a horrific nightmare, my dear.
This is an ad by Regain Couples Therapy.
Let's be honest. Loving your partner doesn't mean you always like them. And guess what? That's normal.
Regain, powered by BetterHelp, offers couples therapy that's flexible, affordable, and 100% online.
Whether you're reconnecting or working through conflict, Regain is here to support you both.
See why people wish they'd tried couples therapy sooner. Visit regain.com/couplespod to get 10% off your first month. That's regain.com/couplespod.
You have 5 new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today.
Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week.
Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.
Sally from Finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
Lowe's knows how to help you save this 4th of July. Upgrade your laundry routine with the new and exclusive first-of-its-kind all-in-one vented laundry combo. Wash and dry in just 68 minutes. Save up to 40% on select major appliances. Plus, when you buy more, you save more. Shop Samsung this July 4th at Lowe's. Valid through 7/9. See Lowe's.com for details. Savings vary based on purchase amount. Selection varies by location.
If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.